This is number 0090, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0090. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Jeff Mudgett, who is the author of Bloodstains, which shares the story of his great-great-grandfather, a man who was a prolific serial killer in the United States, and may have even been Jack the Ripper.
He was a doctor who graduated from the University of Michigan Medical School. He made a living selling skeletons in America. His were known as the most pristine, and they probably were presented in half the medical schools in America. You can imagine why they were the most pristine.
Composer Tim Rideout talks about his latest project, the music score for the web series comic Neuroblast.
The art form is called a motion comic. So basically, it's a comic strip that's animated in 2D using very basic movements, almost like flash animation, you know what I mean? Like with tweening and things that are like the backgrounds will move and the people will move and the scenes change and the camera angles change, but you don't get any, there's no 3D, there's no blinking of eyes or anything like that. It's basically an animated comic strip.
Stuart Nullman joins us with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and this time Book Banter takes a loving look at the battling Burtons in Furious Love, as well as a couple of other titles dealing with two other famous Hollywood couples. It's all coming up later on the Stuff File program.
And, of course, there's lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the week. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0090, is actually someone you hear on the show each and every week. It's Bob DiRigo Jones, senior fellow at the Center for America and creator of the Wacky Warning Label Contest. He's also the host of Let's Be Fair. Those are the segments you hear on this show each and every week. Thank you very much, Bob, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File. By the way, people can check out his website, and you'll find the links for the website on the Stuff File page. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? While there are still those who believe that the year 2012 is the year that the world will end, Edwin Ramos of Vineland, New Jersey, wants you to know that information is incorrect. He's currently busy traveling the East Coast in his RV, warning people that the end is actually coming much sooner. It's coming this month, on May 21st to be exact. Ed says the discrepancy would not exist if there had been a biblical year zero after B.C. and before A.D. Ed's father apparently does not share his son's view because he accepted ownership of Ramos's successful construction business as Ed came to the conclusion that with the end of the world just weeks away, there was no reason to continue conducting business. Yeah. Oh, how I'd love to be able to interview this guy on May 22nd. Yeah, love to. But anyway, moving right along. Unless you've been, you know, living under a rock or in a cave, then you know Osama bin Laden's dead. Boy, there was a lot of irony in that statement, huh? Anyway, nearly 10 years ago in East Wenatchee, Washington, at a middle school there, middle school teacher Gary Weddle took a solemn personal vow that he would not shave or cut his beard until Osama bin Laden was captured or proven dead. After spending most of the last decade looking like a member of ZZ Top, he's now a clean-shaven man. Upon hearing of the terrorist's death, Gary said, "I spent the first 5 minutes crying, and then I couldn't get it off fast enough." Gary said he wanted to cut his beard for years, and so did his wife, Danita. But for Gary, a vow is a vow, and so he hadn't even trimmed it until Sunday night. Weddle was a substitute teacher in Wenatchee when the infamous 9/11 terrorist attack occurred on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. He got so caught up in the news that he neglected to shave, and a week or so later he vowed not to shave until bin Laden was captured or proven dead. At the time, he figured it would just be a month or two. At the start of each school year, Gary told his students the beard was a reminder of the attack. He frequently said he didn't understand how anyone could use the name of his God to justify murder. As for Gary's wife, Danita, she says, "He looks 10 years younger. It's a very happy moment for us. It's a very happy moment for the whole nation." Now there's a guy who can definitely keep his word. Okay, we have a few more stories dealing with that terrorist guy. Now, a week ago, while most were celebrating the news of the death of Osama bin Laden, 23-year-old New Yorker Maurice Harare saw dollar signs. The opportunistic entrepreneur immediately created a website, osamadeadtees.com. And yes, I've put a link into the Stuff File website, so you can go right there if you want to take a look. Now, this site, he had it up and running by 3:30 a.m. Monday. That's less than 5 hours after the announcement. By Tuesday night, he had already sold over 10,000 T-shirts at $12 a pop. That's $120,000, folks. A more established website, Zazzle.com, and yes, there's a link to my website there too, which allows customers to customize their own items like T-shirts, mugs, and buttons, has reportedly handled thousands of bin Laden-related orders last week as well, including one that was placed almost an hour prior to President Obama's official announcement. Really? Wow. Zazzle marketing director Mike Carnes said, "It's been boiling up for 10 years, and this is a moment where people can finally express their sentiment." And finally, in this section of the Stuff File news, the Hampton Inn in Springfield, Ohio, had a big problem. The rope inside the hotel's flagpole broke last Sunday, leaving Old Glory stranded at half-mast for several days. Now, normally, this wouldn't be such a big deal, but, of course, last Sunday was the day that it was announced that Osama bin Laden had been killed. So, now the Hampton Inn is flying the American flag at half-staff. Well, some of the locals thought the hotel was showing support for bin Laden, and General Manager Connie Smith says the call started coming in like crazy. Close to 24 irate Springfielders took to their phones to express outrage that the hotel would pay respect in the death of an Al-Qaeda leader like this. One woman, in tears, demanded to know whether the hotel owners were from Iraq, Iran, or Pakistan. The answer on that is no, no, and no. Ironically, the hotel had been in the act of performing a most patriotic duty, that is, replacing a fraying flag when the rope broke. Ah, yes. God love those knee-jerk reactions. Emphasis on jerk. Let's get to our first guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? Well, Jeff Mudgett is the author of what's being called a harrowing, terrifying memoir. It's entitled Bloodstains. It deals with the possibility that his great-great-grandfather may have been Jack the Ripper. Jeff is on the line with us right now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Coming up with that idea that your great-great-grandfather may be Jack the Ripper, and aside from that, a serial killer in his own right, is not exactly something that a lot of people want to delve into if they find that in their history. Why write a book about it?
You know, that's a great question. I had a fairly normal life till I was 40, 45, and one dinner party with the family, we all found out that my grandfather had been holding a secret from us, even his wife, and came clean about our great-great-grandfather being probably the most evil man that ever walked the planet, and his name was Herman Webster Mudgett, better known as H.H. Holmes. There's been 20 books written about him, movies. He was the character that they used to form Hannibal Lecter, and it was something that, you're right, I at first would not have imagined writing a book and telling the world about.
And yet now you have done it with the book entitled Bloodstains. How long of a process, how much wrestling did you have to do with yourself before you decided to write the book, and how long did it take you to write the book?
You know, it took me about 5 years, and it was only after my grandfather, after he died, left me some secret family heirlooms which discussed this man in his own words, words that the world had never seen. And I used them to go off in a search for the truth, really, to see if what I was reading could possibly be true.
And what you discovered, did it disturb you? Only because I say, you know, it's not like you're looking at a piece of history, but you're looking at a piece of your own family history and basically your own DNA.
Oh, well, the DNA, that part is a big section of the book. And Peter, what you're talking about is exactly what hit me between the eyes. The question in my life became, what was I if he was that? And as I got more deeper into his nature, my search, which started off as a simple search for the truth, became an obsession, and the obsession became a mental condition, which I had to fight off for those 5 years. And at the end, writing the book and telling the truth about who he was and what I was also became a catharsis.
You say your grandfather, rather, didn't spring this on the family until later in life, and that he never even told his own wife.
That's true. There was a stigma in the 19th century, mostly Chicago, New York as well, where this man had been the subject of really the O.J. Simpson trial of the 19th century, covered by every paper in the country. He had been found guilty for murder. He admitted to killing 27. The authors before me estimated it was over 200. My investigation leads me to believe it was probably in closer to 2,000 people
Wow.
that he murdered.
The whole idea of keeping this quiet, we live in a society pretty much less now than then, but we lived in a society where it was guilt by association. Your grandfather is his son. How difficult was it for your grandfather, or did he discuss this with you, the difficulty of growing up knowing what his father was?
My grandfather never mentioned it, and a matter of fact, at that dinner party when the name was mentioned by my brother, he stood up, slammed his chair back, the painting fell off the wall, and said that name will never be mentioned in this house again, and stormed out of the room. And we never discussed it again. The only thing that came up later was, like I say, when he passed away, he left me the diaries of the killer, and that was his way of telling me that he wanted someone else to know the truth, I think.
Actually, I misspoke. He's your great-great-grandfather, so he's your grandfather's grandfather, right?
That's right. That's correct.
Okay. Just want to make sure I get that clear. So there's also, as I said in the introduction, not only the possibility that the facts that he was a serial killer, the possibility that he may have been Jack the Ripper?
I'm convinced. I don't know if I'll be able to prove it. I'm working right now with a detective in Philadelphia who's comparing his handwriting of the notes he wrote in prison with the Ripper letters, who is working very closely with Scotland Yard. They're very interested in as well. And we've established that he went to London that summer on a Cunard Line cruiser. He visited the University of London. The man was a doctor. I stepped on that, but he was a doctor. He graduated from the University of Michigan Medical School. He made a living selling skeletons in America. His were known as the most pristine, and they probably were presented in half the medical schools in America. You can imagine why they were the most pristine. We've established that he visited the University of London Medical School to try to sell skeletons to them, and he was there studying, investigating his research in hormones and longevity. And I don't think there's any question that at least the first two or three murders, the Ripper murders, were conducted by Herman Mudgett, and the authorities there have long believed that it was a surgeon who was capable of removing ovaries from a woman in less than 4 minutes on the street. And I don't know whether we'll be able to prove it. If the handwriting comes in clear, that is pretty strong direct evidence, and it'll be interesting to disclose that to the world when we have it.
Now, you yourself and the current generation of your family didn't get to know this late in life. Now you've written this book, and I'm assuming you'd like to see it do well. Does that not pose a problem for you, for subsequent generations of the family, knowing the history of the family so well and how it might affect, like I said, future generations?
You know, at first, the family was pretty unanimous against me with this project, and but now that they've read the book and seen how satisfying it is to the family when it proves that even with these genetics and with this blood in our souls, the men and women that came after him were all good American citizens that did really well in life, and none of them were criminals. And I like to broadcast that to the world, and I think my family's proud of it.
Now, with someone who is so prolific in murdering people, and as you say, you estimate that his victims could be in the thousands, not just in the hundreds or in double digits, which either way you cut it, it's a large number of people. You are the ancestor of, or the descendant, I should say, of a serial killer. There are also descendants of victims. Have you heard from any or been in contact with any?
Yes, I have. And actually, the meetings started off rough. And by the time they ended, they were... we left as very close, and I don't quite know how to explain the feelings that they had as they realized that their hatred for what happened to their ancestors had nothing to do with me, and that my willingness to talk with them in the open and not hide anything was a good thing. And and they left, we left friends, and it was an amazing thing to see.
Is that one of the lessons you want people to learn by reading this book, besides your family history?
You know, what I'd like people to see reading this book is that this is not a book to enjoy. This is a book to experience. But if you stick with it, if you stay with it till the end, there is a conclusion that is satisfying, not just for me and my family, but also for... maybe many human beings, to see that we are not put on this earth in form, and that you can do anything you really want to do, and if you put your mind to it.
The book is entitled Bloodstains, and people can check out the website, which is bloodstainsthebook.com. Jeff, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
And Peter, thank you very much, and they can also get it on Amazon. We have an ebook on Amazon that's doing quite well.
Jeff Mudgett, author of Bloodstains. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the Stuff File program page for this show, which is show number 0090, and you'll find links to Jeff's website, plus links to Amazon.com, where you can order his book directly for the Kindle. It's also important to note that Jeff's murderous ancestor, Herman Webster Mudgett, is about to be immortalized on the big screen and played by none other than Leonardo DiCaprio.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Viewer discretion is advised. But then again, why are you scaring at a radio program?
And still to come on the program, we'll meet composer Tim Rideout. Plus, we'll have another edition of Book Banter with Stuart Nullman. And, of course, there is an idiot of the day. And lots more Stuff File news, including right here, right now. In Liberty Township, Ohio, sheriff's deputies were called to a residential neighborhood after a report that a Lakota East High School senior was naked on the street, along with two other young men who were wearing clothes. The call came from a woman who didn't want her kids seeing a naked teen. The three were gone by the time police arrived, but a neighbor across the street said he knew that the naked person was a senior at Lakota East. It seems for several years, students at East have been playing a game called Nerf Wars, where participants try to find players on other teams and assassinate them with the soft foam rubber projectiles that come from Nerf guns. Now, there are rules against shooting people at school and while they are working. And there is another rule that says you can't shoot a person that is naked. Apparently, one unmodest player was trying to take advantage of that little-used rule. The school has reportedly sent a letter to parents about the issue. So, you can't kill someone who is naked. Information that's too late for Bin Laden. Elsewhere in the Stuff File news, a suburban Chicago man thought he had the perfect chick magnet in his pet alligator. Authorities only saw a dangerous animal, though. A charge of possession of a dangerous animal has been filed against 43-year-old Dwayne Yarbrough of Ford Heights, who claims he kept a 4-foot alligator to impress women. Yarbrough told Cook County Sheriff's investigators he kept the alligator in a small tank and fed it only 10 live mice a month to keep it from growing too large. He said he bought the gator 5 years ago in Indiana for $200. Animal control investigators did not say how they learned of the alligator, which they found in Yarbrough's kitchen. The alligator was taken to the Animal Welfare League and will be given to the Chicago Herpetological Society. An alligator to impress women, right? Dude, come on. The only way an alligator impresses women is if it's turned into a handbag and a matching pair of shoes. Moving right along, in Rensselaer, New York, 21-year-old Nicholas S. Vollmer was a passenger in a car that police had pulled over for a possible traffic violation. For some reason, Nicholas was under the impression that he was wanted by police, so he bolted from the car, ran across the Amtrak train tracks, and jumped into the freezing Hudson River. Kind of dumb thing to do when you think about it, since there wasn't any warrant out for his arrest. Deputy Police Chief James Frankowski said he just took a swim for no reason at all. Police finally pulled Nick from the frigid river about 250 feet downstream from where he jumped in by the train station. Couldn't have been too much fun, as the Hudson River averages about 40 to 45 degrees Fahrenheit at this time of the year. I'm willing to bet the cops are going to be looking into this guy's past, because, you know, that's really a guilty conscience there if I've ever seen one. Really. And the U.S. built a fence along the Mexican border to increase security and reduce drug trafficking from Mexico. But smugglers in San Luis Rio, Colorado, and Sonora, Mexico, are showing their ingenuity in overcoming the barrier. Border Patrol agents east of Yuma, Arizona, discovered a large truck parked on the Mexican side of the fence with a folding ramp that allowed drug couriers to jump their cars over the fence. Now, agents found the ramp-equipped truck after chasing down a Jeep Cherokee that made it over the fence with a half a ton of marijuana. Wow, if the U.S. ever builds a higher fence, maybe Mexico can start their own space program. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest, with me, Peter Anthony Holder, here on the Stuff File program, West Fargo, North Dakota police have a program to provide gasoline vouchers to people who have to get somewhere important but can't afford the gas to make the trip. Dalton Bayer, age 19, of Charlestown, Indiana, came into the police station and told officers he needed to get to Wisconsin to attend a funeral. When Bayer presented his car's registration and insurance information, police were a tad suspicious. The car was registered to a service station 300 miles away. Officers called the owner, who told police that he had just noticed that the car was missing. That kind of put an end to any gas voucher that he was going to get, a police spokesman said. It also kind of put an end to Bayer's freedom. He was arrested for vehicle theft. Wow. You know, this guy came dangerously close to being the idiot of the day, but that comes later. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Cue the music! Now is a musical score created by composer Tim Rideout, and if you go to Tim's website, it lists him as a recording artist, music producer, and new media musician. His latest project is for Radio Canada, that's the French television network here in Canada. The show is the hipster motion web series comic called Neuroblast, and this music you're hearing right now is from Neuroblast. Tim is on the line with us right now. Hi, Tim.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
I'm just doing tickety-boo. Glad to have you on the program with us. I mentioned in the introduction, new media musician. You have to add new things onto your hyphenate. What exactly is new media musician?
Well, it would be, I suppose, a musician who has evolved perhaps far beyond his original erudition, if you will.
Ooh, I like that.
So somebody who uses new trinkets, programs, somebody who's tech-savvy, I would say, and who has embraced perhaps, I suppose, the sort of new media revolution, which in my mind started with the advent of the DJ using the turntable as an instrument, which was, you know, quite a while ago that started, but it's turned into, I suppose you would call the iPad now the pinnacle of the new media insofar as what you can play as a really funky techno instrument these days.
You've been at this game for a while, and of course you were trained to do this in school and university, but have you seen the business change dramatically because of technology in the last few years?
Huge changes. I would say the biggest change that I've seen in recent memory would have to be, well, two changes, really. Number one is the cheapness of the personal computer. So technology is basically accessible to anyone now. I mean, you can have a recording studio in your home for under $2,000. I mean, literally, maybe even under $1,000. That's the big one. It's just the accessibility to technology. So the personal computer has been the great democratizer in terms of production of music. Does that mean all music produced by everyone is great? No, certainly not, as we've seen on YouTube. And which brings me to number two, would be iTunes was the hugest, one of the biggest revolutions in the music industry, like, ever. It's just phenomenal. I mean, basically, it killed CDs and allowed anybody and everybody to put music online, bypassing the record stores, the brick and mortar. I mean, everybody's heard about Napster and what that did. So all of these changes are technologically based, and they've all happened probably within the last 20 years. There's been a huge, huge change.
Now, let's get to the project that you just recently did, and that is Neuroblast. Tell us about that, because it's a very interesting way in which you created the score for this.
Yeah. Well, first off, the art form is called a motion comic. So basically, it's a comic strip that's animated in 2D using very basic movements, almost like flash animation, you know what I mean? Like with tweening and things that are like the backgrounds will move and the people will move and the scenes change and the camera angles change. But you don't get any, there's no 3D, there's no blinking of eyes or anything like that. It's basically an animated comic strip. And Marvel has done many on their website, and they're very much into that. And there's a big undercurrent of motion comics on the web. So CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, decided to do one. So basically, they got together an elite team of multimedia people and guys who can, like myself, who wear any number of hats and who can do a whole bunch of things. So the creative process for this was very interesting, and I did the music, the sound design, and I actually did the video editing. And it's a story that's based right here in Montreal. It's about kids who are going to McGill, and they're indulging in extracurricular activities, experiments on the brain, and searching for a cure for Alzheimer's, basically, because one of the kids' mothers has the disease. And of course, they're approached by clandestine organizations who want the secret formula, and all hell breaks loose. So it's very interesting because it's based in fact and lore and legend around, of course, the McGill University's implication with the CIA and brain experiments in the post-war era. So it's a very interesting story that's done very well and very modern sort of production.
Now, when one traditionally thinks of composers, they do not get the image that one can check out in your making of video that they can see on your website. You've stepped out of the studio to collect the sounds required to put this score together, haven't you?
Yeah, it was a very a very guerrilla sort of approach. Like, really, you need something, you go and do it. So, for example, I'm doing the sound design, okay? And we need the sound of Felix, the main character. He's running towards the skyscraper downtown. So I need to record the sound of him running. So I put on my shoes. I take my, speaking of iPads or iPods, I take my iPod, plug a mic into it, and I go run down the alley. I bring the iPod back into my studio, transfer what I've just done over to my timeline in my digital editing program, and boom, there we go. We have instant Foley. It sounds very realistic, and that's one of the approaches that we took to the sound design, was to have absolute realism. So you see somebody move, you hear something move. I even went so far as to, when there's people in bed and they're talking on the phone, there's a scene, I took the mic and I'm like rolling around in the bed, and my girlfriend's looking at me like, what the hell are you doing? So it was a very, very interesting process for the sound design. Now, for the music as well, it's a very interesting combination of orchestral scoring, because it's a very cinematic look to it, and a combination of the orchestral with the electronic and ambient sounds. So it's almost as if the music becomes part of the sound design. It's all sort of one big soundscape, if you will.
Now, as, again, someone who is classically trained in music, do having these bells and whistles, all these toys, does it really enhance creativity from your perspective, from what we would refer to as traditional music? Is it like, wow, now that I have this, I can really do X, Y, and Z?
I'm a total hacker. Like, I love it. I love anything that you can, like, plug in and do weird crap with. Like, I have a guitar amp here that's like the size of a matchbox, and have a what's called a chaosilator, is basically a synthesizer that you play with your finger by moving it on a like a little mouse pad. So I think there's really no limit to what you can or what you should do. But of course, you have to keep that always within the context of the art that you're doing. So, on this particular project, the director had a specific musical vision in mind, or we came up with a specific musical vision together. So, I was not able to use my little, you know, cigarette amplifier or my 1960s retro stylophone that sounds like a David Bowie. Wackiness from from his era. So yeah, it has to remain in the context even when you're being creative, especially within the context of I don't want to say corporate, but jobs that you're getting paid to do. Of course, you have to be a professional, even though you're an artist. You know what I mean?
Now, Neuroblast will that be an ongoing series?
That's 13 episodes, and the final episode is actually out on today, the 6th. And so starting today, people can actually watch all 13 episodes on the CBC site. If you go to radiocanada.ca, or you can even go to my site, timrideout.com, and there's a link directly on the first page from there. So you can watch the whole series now. It's really cool.
So people can go again to your website, which is timrideout.com, and they can find all the information.
Yeah,
and
find the links there at the top. Yeah,
and I also urge them to check out that making of video, because that's very interesting indeed as well.
Yeah, the making of, they did a making of for each of the creative departments, and you see me running down the alley, and I'm recording ambiences in New York City because there was a lot of parts in New York, and. Etc. It was a very, very fun project, and really pushed me to the limits of what I have to do when I wear each of my hats.
The show is called Neuroblast, and Tim, thank you very much for being on the program with us. Nice to have you on the show.
My pleasure, Peter. It's always a pleasure.
Composer Tim Rideout. You can check out the work he's done by visiting his website at timrideout.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the Stuff File program page for this show, which is show number 0090, and you'll find links to Tim's website. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. As the author of a best-selling book about warning labels called Remove Child Before Folding, I've heard quite a few stories about product warnings over the years. A friend told me a story that shows how the lawsuit explosion that inspired wacky warning labels has also created unnecessary fear. She told me that her mother had returned several new heating pads because she was too scared to use them. On every heating pad, she found a label that said, "Caution, risk of fire." Well, afraid of starting a fire, she returned them all, and she's still looking for a so-called safe one. Now, let's be fair, most of us know product makers have to warn us about all kinds of dangers, even the unlikely ones, because they can be sued if they don't. But I also know my friend's mom isn't the only one to choose not to use a product because of a scary label. Warning labels are supposed to help us, but unfortunately, fear of lawsuits sometimes makes safe products seem dangerous. That's no way for Americans to live. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
What are they saying about if the rains don't cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up?
If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Abidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nolman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And we do indeed have once again with us Stuart Nolman and another edition of Book Banter. Hello, Stuart.
Hello, Peter. How you doing?
Just tickety-boo.
Well, I experimented with eBay. I don't know if I told you this before.
Don't think so.
No, I bought a book on eBay. Actually, when you sent me through Facebook that notice that Arthur Marx passed away, Groucho's son.
Right.
I went on eBay because I'm going to be doing a purchase a book for a gift through eBay in the future. And I saw a first edition of his book about his dad called Life with Groucho, published in 1954. So I bought it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Just got it a few days ago.
Interesting. Another great story of, I guess you could say, a Hollywood memoir, as it were.
Oh, yes. And I read it before, and it's very funny, but it's always special to get that first edition, especially when for the price I paid for it, which was pretty good.
Excellent. Excellent. And speaking of Hollywood memoirs or Hollywood stories, I believe you have one for us this week.
Yes, that's right. I do, actually, on this edition of Book Banter. We're going to look at Liz and Dick. You know, when Elizabeth Taylor died in March at the age of 78, she was fondly remembered for her striking beauty, her many classic movies, as well as her tireless efforts raising money and awareness of AIDS and AIDS research. As well, she was remembered for her 8 marriages, especially numbers 5 and 6, to Welsh actor Richard Burton. From their first meeting on the set of Cleopatra during the early 60s to their final performance together on stage in Private Lives nearly 25 years later, Burton and Taylor, or Liz and Dick as they were commonly known, had a relationship that captured the interest and hearts of fans and gossip columnists around the world. Everything they did on camera and off camera were grist for the public mill. From their extravagant lifestyles to the outlandish spending, they even had they purchased a very expensive diamond for like $1 million and called the Burton Taylor Diamond. To the 10 films they appeared together, like The Sandpiper and, of course, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, to their volatile arguments. Basically, it was the ideal toxic Hollywood romance that the public couldn't get enough of. You know, Furious Love, by Sam Cashner and Nancy Schoenberger, is the first book to take an in-depth look at this famous Hollywood pairing. And what the reader gets is a story that a screenwriter couldn't make up if their vivid imagination worked overtime, actually. They couldn't make it up if they tried. So Cashner and Schoenberger have really done a great deal of diligent research and reporting on the complete story of Liz and Dick and what made them such a fascinating Hollywood couple. And the authors also write quite extensively of how the volatile marriage was destructive for both parties involved. Burton drank quite heavily during that time, which brought him to a near-death experience in 1974. Taylor underwent a series of health problems and hospitalizations, which also led to a dependence on alcohol and prescription drugs, not to mention her famous seesawing weight problems. And as well, Taylor had to endure Burton's ongoing womanizing on and off the set. However, one of the most surprising aspects of this book is the author's extensive quoting of Burton's diary, which shows how passionate was his love for Elizabeth, not to mention his keen observances of his life in the spotlight as Mr. Elizabeth Taylor. And he writes with so much clarity and eloquence, it's quite surprising that he never decided to take up a second career as a published author. Furious Love is a fascinating, bittersweet saga of the Hollywood starlet and the rough-hewn Welsh actor who should have never had a romance together, but ended up in a showbiz relationship that was both infuriating and enduring.
Although you do mention the effects that the marriage had on her and on the marriage had on him, I kind of question that, though, because as far as her yo-yoing weight, her weight became a bigger problem, at least not for her, but for John Warner. Yeah. than anybody else. He had a big issue with that. And also, Liz Taylor, as phenomenal an actress as she was and a great person, had a definite cloud over her when it came to her health. I don't think married to Richard Burton would have affected that one way or another. She had health problems, God rest her soul, all through her life, which she managed to get past and get through, with exception, of course, the last time.
Oh, exactly. And, they had this very high life. I mean, they never even had a fixed address during that time as well. That was another little effect. I mean, it didn't affect the children that they raised, but, you know, they had their own yacht. They cruised along throughout Europe and lived in hotels. So, you know, it was toxic, but also, I mean, but people just couldn't get enough of them. That was the funny thing about it, no matter throughout their faults. And Richard liked to make a little bit of fun of Elizabeth and her weight problem too. But, it just never seemed to affect their relationship. Even though they married twice and they did divorce twice, they still had a very deep fondness for each other. And I think that's very, very unusual for Hollywood romances, if you ask me.
But that last marriage was very short.
Yeah, I mean, not even a year.
Yeah.
Not even a year. But if you want to read more about a couple of – I have a couple of suggestions about if you want to read about famous Hollywood pairings. Like I said, these books are no longer in print, but you can always go to a secondhand bookstore and find them. First of all, Garson Kanin wrote a bestselling book about Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn called Simply Tracy and Hepburn, which is an excellent biography of the two, this very famous Hollywood pairing, although they never married. They could have been. And this is from the point of view of a Hollywood insider. Garson Kanin was a very well-known, well-respected screenwriter and author. And that was published in 1970, which you can get in paperback. The second book is called Bogart and Bacall. Now, it's by Joe Hyams. It was published in 1975. Hyams was best known for writing the first definitive biography of Humphrey Bogart in 1965. And like Garson Kanin, he's a Hollywood insider. He was a well-known columnist. And also traced how this couple, even though they were 20 years age difference, worked out so well together. And it's, there are no other books that are written about Bogie and Bacall. And this is the first and definitive look at this very famous Hollywood pair. And they did some great movies together as well. I mean, Key Largo is one of my favorites too.
Excellent. So today's book is
Furious Love by Sam Kashner and Nancy Schoenberger. It's in paperback. It's published by It Books, a division of HarperCollins. And it's $18.99.
And it's the story of Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. And if people want to find you, how can they do so?
Well, you can read me every week in the West End Times, either in print, or if you don't have it in print, you can see me online at www.westendtimes.ca.
Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter. Thank you very much, Stu.
You're welcome, Peter.
The Stuff File.
And before we wrap up this edition of the Stuff File program, a few more Stuff File news stories and, of course, an idiot of the day, which we'll get to in a bit. You know, it seems to me to be common sense that if a guy sets up a tanning bed business in his barn, that's probably not a place where you want to go. But people in Stark, Florida, apparently thought it would be fine and amazingly were shocked to find out the owner was secretly videotaping their naked bodies. So police have arrested 47-year-old Doyce Dean Griffiths as they try to determine who the victims may have been, including some who appeared to be teens, based on recordings seized when the salon owner was arrested. Griffiths confessed, "I just like to look at pretty girls naked, and it got to a point where it got out of hand," he said. "The recordings were strictly for me." The tanning salon was in a barn behind Griffith's home, and patrons paid $2 for 20 minutes in the tanning bed. The two women who brought this to the attention of police said customers would insert their money into a slot in the wall, then lie in the bed in whatever state of undress they chose. Griffiths confessed to filming female tanners as they undressed before getting into the tanning bed. The video camera was hidden behind a two-way mirror. Police seized four large containers of VHS tapes, 30 or more 8mm cassettes, 41 DVDs, two computer memory cards, the two-way mirror, and a laptop computer. Oh yeah, there's a special place in hell for him, but before he gets there, I'm sure he'll make a whole new set of friends, really close friends, when he's in prison. And we go to Connecticut for our next story. Authorities say a man who was drunk and looking for a place to sleep broke into a trailer behind a Connecticut high school, then instead stole keys to a lawnmower and went for a joyride, during which he mowed his parents' lawn. Police in East Lyme say 22-year-old Nicholas Trombley was caught on tape stealing the lawnmower from East Lyme High School. Police say Trombley told them he was looking for the keys to the school when he found the keys to the lawnmower. He rode it 3 miles to his parents' house, mowed the lawn, and started to head back to the school, but abandoned the mower somewhere on the way. He's charged with third-degree larceny and burglary. But I guess his parents are proud of the fact that he finally mowed the lawn. You always have to look at the positives in stories like this, don't you? Yeah. Think about the positive aspect of things. Okay, speaking of people riding along on vehicles they shouldn't be in places where they shouldn't be riding them, a man driving a moped was seen swerving in and out of traffic in Indianapolis, Indiana. Police officer Christian Rudell pulled him over and gave him a ticket for operating a scooter on an interstate, exceeding the moped speed limit, and driving with a suspended license. Now, after she handed him the ticket, Adam Yarborough, age 22, allegedly asked the officer if she could call it even if he gave her $5. Rudell declined. Yarborough wasn't inclined to give up so easily, so he asked if she wouldn't take back the ticket for cash, how about if he gave her a kiss? And well, he added, according to the resulting report, I haven't had sex in a while, so how about we do that? Rudell arrested him for attempted bribery. When Yarborough continued making sexual remarks and uttering profanities, she added an extra charge of disorderly conduct. Okay, let's see. He's on a scooter, and his initial bribe was $5. Not exactly what you'd call a dream date, is he? Although, saying you haven't had sex in a while is perhaps something you shouldn't mention if you're going to prison. Yes. Now, this is a person who could have been considered the idiot of the day, but he didn't make the cut. But this next person did, as we now present the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I'll present the idiot of the day.
Next time you're planning a break-in with your buddies, best to turn your cell phone off. In Clay, New York, police already looking for a suspicious person got an unlikely assist when one of the men pocket-dialed 911 while driving near the scene of an earlier heist. A dispatcher relayed the conversation to deputies as the men discussed their plans, described their surroundings, and even commented, "There go the cops now." That was enough for one deputy to turn around and stop the Kia Sportage full of stolen goods stolen from a local business. The phone was still on when the deputy approached the car, and the dispatcher then heard the driver being asked for his license and registration. All three men were arrested and faced grand larceny and stolen property charges. Now, the question we always ask, why would someone who is planning some nefarious heist even have their cell phone on them? I mean, would this be a time to take a call or a text from anybody? No. There's only one reason why they would do this, and that reason is, they're idiots.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0090. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0090. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can find a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it, boys and girls. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Let me leave you with these words of wisdom. Never, ever juggle ice picks while standing on your waterbed.